spirit of the United States Constitution has become sufficiently dimmed that laws which are blatantly unconstitutional are frequently proposed and often passed without a murmur of protest. Pockets of totalitarianism exist within government itself. Our society routinely tolerates totalitarian tactics by both federal and local agencies, manifested in the conspicuous use of intimidation. Unfortunately, we have gotten so used to an atmosphere of fear and violence that it comes as a surprise to Americans abroad that the threat of government intrusion or police force does not even exist in many foreign countries. It is most important to remember that to violate principle for practical expediency is to relinquish enormous power. The rationalization that the execution of criminals deters crime, for instance, does not hold up under the study, and the end does not justify the means. The consequence of this violation of principle is reflected in the crime statistics of the United States, where a murder is so common it does not even make the front page. Because we fail to differentiate principle from expediency, the average person lacks the discernment to understand the difference between patriotism with a small p and true patriotism with a large p, or the difference between Americanism with a small a and Americanism with a large a. Likewise, between God with a small g and God with a large g, and between freedom with a small f as compared to freedom with a capital F, and liberty from liberty. Thus, Americanism is used as a justification by white supremacy groups, who calibrated only at 150, as well as lynch mobs, just as war mongering throughout history has been conducted in the name of God. The misinterpretation of liberty as license tells us that many people do not know the difference between freedom as license and true freedom as a principle. Learning the difference between principles and their imitators requires experience and educated judgment. The exercise of such discretion is necessary for moral survival in the modern world in general, but is imperative in those gray areas where ethical ambiguity has been elevated from convention to an art form, the political arena and the marketplace of daily commerce.
Chapter 11. Power in the Marketplace.
Man has freedom of choice, without which there would be no accountability or responsibility. The ultimate choice, really, is whether to align with a high-energy attractor field or a low-energy attractor field. The same weak attractor patterns that have brought down governments, social movements, and entire civilizations routinely destroy organizations and careers. One makes one's choice and then takes the consequences. Nowhere are these consequences more dramatically visible than in the realm of business. Nowhere else, however, could failure be more easily avoided if a few basic concepts were clearly understood. Attractor fields can be quickly calibrated, whether it is a product, a company, an advertisement, or an employee. In our research, the differences between businesses that have failed and businesses that have succeeded have proved so marked that excellent predictive accuracy can be expected. All too often, the buyer, who could be a voter, investor, or truth seeker, as well as a purchaser, is captured by the glamour of an imitator pattern, which on the surface appears to be a high-energy attractor pattern. People are dazzled by superficial style and slick presentations, like those naive investors who bought silver only to find that the entire commodity market had been manipulated. Our notorious savings and loan fiascos and their perpetrators could easily have been identified long before the scandals surfaced. Similar disasters can be avoided by simply examining whether a business endeavor is associated with a high or a low attractor pattern. This identification can become almost instinctive once one understands the difference between the operation of force and power in commerce. Sam Walton, the founder of Walmart, provides a model of how power comes from aligning with high-energy attractor patterns. The ABC, which he conceived, has resulted in the A causes B causes C manifestation in the world, that is, the rapidly growing Walmart colossus. The basic principles involved are spelled out in the book Sam Walton by Vance Trimble. In the aisles of many of today's giant stores, there seems to be no employees whatsoever. The gross indifference to customer goodwill is shocking. Walmart's employees, in contrast, are trained to be accommodating, warm, and energetic. They are trained to reflect a humane energy field in their workplace. Their jobs have meaning and value because they are aligned with service, a commitment to the support of life and human value. All Walmart stores feature an area where you can rest your feet and decide about purchases. Such an allocation of space to meet simple human needs would not pass the scrutiny of purely scientific management calculations in terms of gross sales per square foot. But such efficiency expertise has discarded, along with human compassion, the market allegiance of millions of customers. Computers don't feel. More attention would be paid to feelings if it were raised that feelings determine purchases. A commercial factor of great, though often unrecognized, importance is the family feeling of employees, their loyalty to each other and to their organization. This is a very prominent quality in successful companies. Employees who feel nurtured and supported are those who smile genuinely at customers. Another characteristic of such an environment is low employee turnover, whereas cold and impersonal companies have very rapid employee turnover. Employee shortage is always an expression of a low attractor energy pattern. Critical factor analysis of a large cut-rate drug chain that had just gone Chapter 11 revealed that the few dollars saved by not having extra employees at the checkout counter regularly cost thousands of dollars in sales. Such short-sightedness is common in businesses dominated by low-energy fields. To be a success, it is necessary to embrace and operate from the basic principles that produce success and to not just imitate the actions of successful people. To really do what they do, it is necessary to be like they are. Companies that have imitated some of Walmart's features in hopes of regaining market share have not been successful because they merely imitated the A-B-C instead of aligning with the ABC, that is the core concept, from which these features emanated. Our research on attractor patterns correlates closely with the conclusions arrived at by Peters and Waterman in their work In Search of Excellence, a detailed analysis of several great companies. They concluded that successful companies were those which had heart, as opposed to strictly left-brain, scientifically managed companies. In reading this study, one cannot help but be struck by the inadequacy of many marketing survey procedures. The statisticians simply don't know what questions to ask. In addition to counting the millions that companies make, analysts might well assess the multi-millions that they did not make. A good example is the recent decline in the U.S. auto industry. One would think it would be apparent from the success of the Rolls-Royce or the Volkswagen Beetle that espousing a philosophy of planned obsolescence rather than enduring quality demonstrates a gross miscalculation. Our research indicated years ago that by following the high-energy attractor patterns we have already identified, Detroit could reclaim the auto market. Truly creative innovation is required in order to recapture the imagination of the public. An enduring quality must supplant planned obsolescence, as the price of a new car approaches well over $20,000. Sensibly enough, not many Americans are happy to lay out such sums in full knowledge that that investment will surely be lost to obsolescence. Obviously, what the depreciating car loses is not any real innate value. The inflated price of glamour and novelty does not reflect any actual worth. People will gladly pay $50,000 or more for a used Rolls-Royce, knowing that 20 years from now it will still be classic in style, mechanically sound, with a high resale value, maybe even higher than that which they paid in the first place. Our research indicates that Americans would willingly pay such high prices for cars if their intrinsic worth were equivalent to their purchase price, so as to protect the investment, and if they would run well and maintain value a long time, ideally a lifetime. For instance, a modular car, in which the motor, drivetrain, etc., were easily removable and replaceable, with a lifetime guarantee, that would certainly be a sure winner. Attractor research tells us that customers are willing to pay for quality and that good products would sell themselves without slick advertising gimmicks. Integrity and excellence speak for themselves because they are aligned with power. One of the most profitable and simple applications of critical factor analysis is in the field of advertising. The use of the simple kinesiologic technique we have described can instantly reveal whether an advertising campaign or a given commercial makes people go weak or strong. Companies pay enormous sums to reach the greatest possible audiences, but this strategy can then backfire when a widely viewed commercial that makes viewers go weak damages the company's image. An ad that makes people go strong will always produce a positive feeling about the product rather than an aversion. Similarly, advertisers who buy time during TV programs that make people go weak will find their product unconsciously associated with these negative feelings. By analyzing a commercial in detail, one can ascertain the elements that have a weakening negative effect. Sometimes it's the voice of the announcer, the mannerisms of an actor, or the use of certain words, concepts, or symbols. That some companies repeatedly produce tasteless and even embarrassing commercials reflects low attractor feels prevalent in their advertising and marketing departments. Beyond the surface world of commerce, society provides numerous other marketplaces where fulfillment of human needs is sought, bartered, stolen, coerced, and denied. It is a simple fact of life that satisfaction of needs brings contentment. Frustration breeds violence, crime, and emotional turmoil. If the mission of government regulatory institutions were realigned to support the fulfillment of human needs, rather than mounting moralistic black-and-white campaigns to stamp out social problems, these institutions could become powerful forces for human betterment. Perceptual fields are limited by the attractor pattern with which they are associated. This means that the capacity to recognize significant factors in a given situation is limited by the context that arises from the level of consciousness of the observer. The motive of the viewer automatically determines what is seen. Causality is, therefore, ascribed to factors that are in fact a function of the biases of the observer and are not at all instrumental in the situation itself. The concept of situational ethics tells us that the right or wrong of behavior cannot be determined without reference to context. As each conditioning factor colors the picture, shades of gray are introduced that alter the significance of the whole scenario. One indication of a low energy attractor field is a struggle of opposites. Whereas power always results in a win-win solution, force produces win-lose situations. The consequent struggle indicates that the correct solution has not been found, as when the assertion of one's group's interests violates those of another, or the rights of the accused conflict with those of the victim. The way to finesse a high-energy attractor field solution is to seek the answer which will make all sides happy and still be practical. Such solutions involve utilization of both the ameliorative right brain as well as the judgmental left brain. One basic principle has the power to resolve the problems of the social marketplace. It may be stated thusly: support the solution instead of attacking the supposed causes. Attack is in itself inherently a very weak attractor pattern that calibrates at about 150, leading through fear to intimidation, coercion, and eventually moral corruption. The vice squad becomes just that, turning city streets into jungles of crime. Objective examination reveals that most intractables, so-called social problems, appear unsolvable due to the persistence of either sentimentality or juvenile or childish moralizing. Neither of these positions is based on truth, and therefore all approaches proceeding from them are weak. Falsehood makes us all go weak. Acting from false positions typically results in the use of force. Force is the universal substitute for truth. The gun and the nightstick are evidence of weakness. The need to control others stems from lack of power, just as vanity stems from lack of self-esteem. Punishment is a form of violence, an ineffectual substitute for power. When, as in our society, the punishment rarely fits the crime, it can hardly be effectual. Punishment is based on revenge, which represents the weak energy level at about 150. Supporting the solution of human needs, on the other hand, creates a no-cost resolution that brings serenity. Attacking the artificially created problem is always expensive, in addition to criminalizing society. Only the childish proceed from the assumption that human behavior can be explained in black and white terms. Denying basic biologic needs and instinctual drives is futile. Blocking normal sexual outlets merely results in the creation of abnormal sexual outlets. The solutions to that power are the ones realistically based at the level of acceptance at calibration 350, rather than condemnation, which only calibrates at 150. In Amsterdam, for instance, one section of the city is traditionally designated as a red light district. It's quiet and serene with a pastoral atmosphere. Its streets are safe. In Buenos Aires, parts of parks are set aside for lovers. The police patrol these areas in both countries to protect rather than harass, and in both, all is peaceful. Another example is the previously cited government inability to solve the problem of drug use. Again, the mistake is in looking at the problem moralistically and acting out of force in a punitive role. The original critical error was the failure to differentiate between hard drugs and soft drugs. Hard drugs, such as narcotics, are addicting, with severe withdrawal effects, and have been traditionally associated with crime. Soft recreational drugs are non-addicting, do not induce withdrawal, and are usually handled initially by amateurs. By criminalizing soft drugs, the government created a new criminal syndicate, wealthy and international in scope. When prohibition was made effective, it created shortages of cheap, relatively harmless drugs on the street, which were then quickly replaced by hard drug merchants, and the peaceful, largely innocuous drug culture became criminalized and vicious. Successful solutions are based on the powerful principle that resolution occurs not by attacking the negative, but by fostering the positive. Recovery from alcoholism cannot be accomplished by fighting intoxication, but rather by choosing sobriety. The war to end all wars did no such thing, nor could it possibly have done so. Wars, including wars on vice, on drugs, etc., or any of the basic human needs, regularly traded off the great hidden social marketplace that underlies conventional commerce, which can only be won by choosing peace.
Chapter 12. Power and Sports.
The theoretical understanding at which we have arrived in our study of consciousness provides a context which may be applied to any field of human activity. This can be illustrated by an examination of sports, a good example because sport is so widely observed and extensively documented. Great heroes of sports have been celebrated throughout history, at least as much as great figures in science, the arts, or any other area of cultural achievement. Sports figures symbolize for all of us the possibilities of excellence, and at the level of the champion, mastery. What is it in athletics that brings a crowd to its feet and commands wildly enthusiastic loyalty? At first we might think it is pride, a fascination with competition and triumph. But while these motives may produce pleasure and excitement, they cannot account for the far greater emotions of respect and awe elicited by a display of athletic excellence. What animates the crowd is an intuitive recognition of the heroic striving required to overcome human limitation and achieve new levels of prowess. High states of consciousness are also frequently experienced by athletes. It is well documented that long-distance runners frequently attain sublime states of peace and joy. This elevation of consciousness, in fact, often inspires the prolonged transcendence of pain and exhaustion necessary to achieve high levels of performance. This phenomenon is commonly described in terms of pushing oneself to the point where one suddenly breaks through a performance barrier and the activity then miraculously becomes effortless. The body then seems to move with grace and ease of its own accord, as though animated by some invisible force. The accompanying state of joy is quite distinct from the thrill of success. It is a joy of inner peace and oneness with all of life. It is notable that this transcendence of the personal self and surrender to the very essence or spirit of life often occurs at a point just beyond the apparent limit of the athlete's ability. The seeming barrier is predicated by the paradigm of one's own past accomplishments or what has been recognized as theoretically possible, such as the historic 4-minute mile. Until Roger Bannister broke the 4-minute mile, it was universally accepted that it was not humanly possible to run any faster than that. Bannister's greatness was not just in breaking the record, but in breaking through that paradigm to a new model of human possibility. This breakthrough to new levels of potential has correspondence in every field of human endeavor. In many diverse enterprises, those who have achieved greatness have given parallel accounts of the circumstances surrounding their accomplishments. We have made calibrations of various kinds of records of athletic achievement and other areas of human endeavors, such as movies. Of all the movies about sports studied, the French film The Big Blue produced the highest calibration. This is the story of the world's deep-sea diving champion, Jacques Méot, the Frenchman who for many years, until very recently, held the world record. The movie calibrates at the extraordinary energy level of 700. That is the oneness of all of life. The movie itself has the capacity to put viewers into a high state of consciousness. The manager of one movie house, which showed it, described audiences wandering out of the theater, lost in silence or crying with an inner joy, which she had never seen before and could not really describe. The movie achieves an accurate depiction of the world's greatest deep-sea diver in elevated states of consciousness through the use of slow-motion photography. A subjective sensation of slow-motion beauty and grace is frequently noted in higher states. Time seems to stop, and there is an inner silence despite the noise of the world. We see throughout the film that Jacques Méot maintains this state by the intensity of his concentration, which keeps him in an almost constant meditative condition. In this mode, he transcends ordinary human limitation, is enabled to achieve great feats through altered physiology. The deeper he dives, the slower is his heartbeat, and his blood distribution concentrates almost entirely in the brain, as it does, for instance, in the porpoise. His best friend in the movie, himself a highly evolved athlete, dies in the attempt to match Mayo's feet, because he has not reached the level of consciousness required to transcend the normal limits or requirements of the human body. The subjective experience of effortless bliss also occurs in other types of exceptional physical performance, such as that of the world-famous Sufi dancers, also known as the whirling dervishes, who, through discipline and exhausting practice, become able to move effortlessly through space over long periods of time with dazzling precision. The most highly developed martial arts clearly demonstrated how motive and principle are of ultimate importance in extraordinary athletic achievement. The most frequently heard admonition to trainees to stop trying to use force. Schools devoted to these arts produce masters whose overriding concern is victory of the higher self over the lower self through control, training, and commitment to goals aligned with true power. Alignment with these high-power attractor fields is not limited to the exercise of the discipline itself, but becomes an entire lifestyle. Thus, when the power of the principle is transferred to the practitioner, the results begin to be manifested everywhere in their life. The hallmark of true greatness in athletic achievement is always humility, such as was exhibited by Pablo Morales after winning his gold medals in the 1992 Summer Olympics. Such athletes express gratitude, inner awe, and an awareness that their performance was not merely the result of a personal effort, that maximum personal effort brought them to the breakthrough point from which they were then transported by a greater power than that of the individual self. This typically is expressed as the discovery of some aspect of the greater self, with a capital S, heretofore unknown or unexperienced in its pure form. Through kinesiology, we can demonstrate that if one is motivated by any of the energy fields below courage, that one goes weak. The notorious Achilles heel that brings down not just athletes, but the potentially great in all areas of human achievement is pride. Pride, calibrated at 175, not only makes the performer go weak, but cannot provide the motivational power of love, honor, or dedication to a higher principle, or even to excellence itself. If we ask a powerful athlete to hold in mind the hope of defeating his opponent, or becoming a star, or making a lot of money, or becoming famous, we will see that he goes weak, and we can put down his trained muscular arm with minimal effort. The same athlete, however, holding in mind the honor of his country, or his sport, or the dedication of his performance to someone he loves, or even the sheer joy of maximum effort for the sake of excellence, goes powerfully strong, and we cannot push down his arm with even the greatest effort. Thus, the competitor motivated by pride or greed, or who is interested primarily in defeating the opponent, will go weak at the moment of the starting gun and be unable to achieve the maximum continued effort necessary for great achievement. At times, we see an athlete start badly for such reasons, but as the contest progresses and selfish goals are forgotten, we see an improvement in his performance. We also sometimes see the opposite when an athlete starts well, because he is competing for the honor of his country, his team, or the sport itself, and then falter as he nears the goal and the anticipation of personal glory or triumph over a rival makes him lose strength and form. One unfortunate sequence of consciousness occurs when an athlete sets a new record during qualifying trials, arousing new personal ambitions, and then, during the final competition, goes to pieces to the puzzlement of the audience. If top performers are imbued with the knowledge that their excellence is not a personal accomplishment but a gift belonging to all and a demonstration of man's potential, they go strong and remain so throughout the whole event. The scale of consciousness may be seen in one aspect as a scale of ego, with the level of 200 being the fulcrum at which selfishness begins to turn to selflessness. At the rarefied plane of Olympic competition, the disastrous consequences, both in private and in public life, of motivations emanating from levels below 200 were all too clearly illustrated by the scandals at the time. Excessive zeal to capture the Olympic medal and defeat one's opponent by any means available led to the abandonment of the power of ethical principle and then descended to the grossest level of force. There could hardly be a more telling example of how submission to a negative attractor field can produce a rapid collapse of an otherwise promising athletic career. Where higher motivations toward excellence give access to the realm of grace and power, self-centered motivations of personal gain draw one almost magnetically into the realm of force. The reaping of recognition, even in the symbolic form of a medal, let alone the financial reward that may accompany it, has little to do with true athletic greatness, which proceeds from an attainment of stature of the spirit. It is this that we laud in the champion. Even if the competitor does not surrender to the lust for wealth and fame, the drive to attain dominance in one's sport, rather than to simply manifest all the excellence of which one is capable, has its own corrupting egocentric effect, entrainment by the negative forces associated with the level of pride. There is nothing intrinsically wrong with some manifestations of pride. We all may well be proud when we take the America's Cup or the Olympians win medals, but that is a different kind of pride. It is an honoring of human achievement that transcends personal pride. We honor the endeavor, not the personal accomplishment, which is only the occasion and expression of something greater, universal, and innate in the human heart. The Olympics, one of the greatest dramas of human striving, one which captures everyone's imagination, provides a context which should counteract personal pride. The whole setting inspires the competitor to move from personal pride to an esteem, which is an expression of unconditional love, and which honors one's opponents as well, for their dedication to the same lofty principles. The media tend to exaggerate and evoke the downside of sports and undermine the athlete because celebrity status, either consciously or unconsciously, elicits this egotism. Great athletes need to gird themselves against this source of contamination. Humility and gratitude seem to be the only effective shield against the onslaughts of media exploitation. Athletes in the traditional martial arts employ specific exercises to overcome any tendencies towards egotism. The dedication of one's skill, performance, or career to a higher principle provides the only absolute protection. True athletic power is characterized by grace, sensitivity, inner quiet, and paradoxically, gentleness in the non-competitive lives of even fierce competitors. We celebrate the champion because we recognize that he has overcome personal ambition through sacrifice and dedication to a higher principle. The great become legendary when they teach by example, It is not what they have nor what they do, but what they have become that inspires all of mankind, and it is that which we honor in them. We should seek to protect their humility from the forces of exploitation that accompany acclaim in the everyday world. We need to educate the public that the abilities of these athletes and their great performances are gifts to mankind to be respected and defended from the abuse of the media and corporate commerce. The Olympic spirit resides within the heart of every man and woman. Great athletes can, by example, awaken awareness of those principles in all people. These heroes and their spokesmen have a potentially powerful influence on all of mankind, literally the power to lift the world on their shoulders. The nurturing of excellence and the recognition of its value is the responsibility of all men, because the quest for excellence in every area of human endeavor inspires us all towards the actualization of every form of man's yet unrealized greatness.
Chapter 13, Social Power and the Human Spirit.
When we cheer the spirit of the true athlete, what we applaud is a demonstration of all the significances that the word spirit entails for us. Courage, tenacity, commitment, alignment with principle, demonstration of excellence, honor, respect, and humility. To inspire implies filling with spirit. Dispirited means dejected, hopeless, defeated. But what exactly does the term spirit signify? The collective totality of human experience can be comprehended by spirit in phrases such as team spirit, or when we exhort people to get into the spirit of a thing. That spirit is a highly pragmatic factor which can determine the difference between victory or defeat is well known by military commanders, coaches, and CEOs. An employee or other group member who doesn't enter the spirit of the group enterprise soon finds themselves without a job or a group. From all the above, it is clear that the term spirit refers to an unseen essence, and that although its expression varies from one situation to another, the essence itself never changes. This essence is vital. When we lose our spirit, we die. We expire from lack of that which inspires. Clinically speaking, then, we can say that spirit equates with life. The energy of life itself can be termed spirit. Spirit is the aliveness that accompanies and is the expression of alignment with life energy. The power of high energy attractor patterns is anabolic, sustains life. Their opposites are catabolic, eventually leading to death. True power equals life, equals spirit, whereas force equals weakness and eventually death. When an individual has lost or lacks those qualities we term spiritual, he becomes devoid of humanity, love, and self-respect, and becomes selfish and violent. When a nation veers from its alignment with the spirit of man, it can become an international criminal. It is a common error to identify spirituality with religion. We have noted that the United States Constitution, the Bill of Rights, the Declaration of Independence, clearly differentiate between the spiritual and the religious. Government is forbidden to establish any religion, lest it impair the freedom of the people. Yet these same documents presume that government's authority derives essentially from spiritual principles. In fact, the founders of the world's great religions would be shocked at the profoundly unspiritual deeds wrought in their names throughout history, which would make a heathen shudder. Force always distorts truth for its own self-serving purpose. Over time, the spiritual principles upon which religions are based become distorted for expedient ends such as power, money, and other worldliness. Whereas that which is spiritual is tolerant, religiosity is commonly intolerant. The former leads to peace, the latter to strife, bloodshed, and pious criminality. There remains, however, buried within every religion, the spiritual foundation from which it originated. Like religions, entire cultures are weakened when the principles on which they are based are obscured or contaminated by false interpretation. To more fully understand the nature of spirit in power and how it originates and operates as a social movement, we will do well to study a contemporary spiritual organization of enormous power and influence, about which everything is of public record, and one which is avowedly aligned with the spirit of man and yet flatly states that it is not a religion. This example is that of the 55-year-old organization known as Alcoholics Anonymous. In our society, we all have gotten to know something about AA because it has become woven into the very fabric of modern society, and its adherents number in the millions. It and its offshoot organizations have been estimated to affect in one way or another the lives of about 50% of Americans at this time. Even where the 12-step-based self-help programs do not enter lives directly, they affect everyone indirectly because they reinforce certain values by example. Let us study the power principles upon which Alcoholics Anonymous is based and how this foundation came about historically, and examine the impact these principles have within the general population as well as among members. We can look at what AA is and also what it is not and learn from both. AA is, according to its preamble, not aligned with any sect, denomination, politics, or organization. It has no opinion on outside matters. It is neither for nor against any other approach to the problem of alcoholism. It has no dues, no fees, no ceremonies, no trappings, no officers, no laws. It owns no property, has no edifices. Not only are all members equal, but all groups are autonomous and self-supporting. Even the 12 basic steps by which members recover are described only as suggestions. The use of coercion of any kind is avoided, and this is emphasized by slogans such as Easy Does It, First Things First, and Live and Let Live. Alcoholics Anonymous respects freedom in that it leaves choice up to the individual. Its identifiable power patterns are those of honesty, responsibility, humility, service, and the practice of tolerance, goodwill, and brotherhood. AA does not subscribe to any particular ethic, has no code of right and wrong, good or bad, and avoids moral judgments. AA does not try to control anyone, including its own members. What it does instead is to chart a path. It merely says to its members, if you practice these principles in all your affairs, you will recover from this grave, progressive, and incurable fatal illness and regain your health, self-respect, and the capacity to live a fruitful and fulfilling life for yourself and others. AA is the original example of the power of these principles to cure hopeless disease and change the destructive personality patterns of members. From this original paradigm came all subsequent forms of group therapy, through the discovery that groups of people coming together on a formal basis to address their mutual problems have enormous power. There arose Al-Anon for the spouses of AA members, then Alateen for their children, then Gamblers Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous, Parents Anonymous, Overeaters Anonymous, and so on. There are now close to 300 anonymous 12-step self-help organizations dealing with every aspect and form of human suffering. Americans, as a result of all this, have now largely turned from condemning self-destructive behaviors to recognizing that these conditions are indeed curable illnesses. From a practical viewpoint, the sizable impact of self-help organizations on society can be counted not only in the relief of human suffering and the reconstitution of families, but also in the saving of billions of dollars. Absenteeism, automobile insurance rates, welfare, health care, and the penal system costs are all greatly moderated by the widespread behavioral change produced by this movement. The cost of state-provided counseling and group therapy alone for the millions of troubled individuals served would be staggering. The members of these organizations collectively, by the millions, unanimously agree that admitting the limitations of their individual egos allowed them to experience a true power, and that it is that power which brought about their recovery, which hitherto nothing on earth, including medicine, psychiatry, or any branch of modern science, have been able to affect. We can make some important observations from the story of how the prototype organization, AA, came into existence. Back in the 1930s, alcoholism was accepted, as it had been over the centuries, as a hopeless progressive disease, which had baffled medical science and religion as well. In fact, the prevalence of alcoholism amongst the clergy itself was very alarmingly high. All forms of drug addiction were thought to be incurable, and when they reached a certain stage, victims were merely put away. In the early 1930s, a prominent American businessman, known to us as Roland H., who had sought every cure for his alcoholism without avail, went to see the famous Swiss psychoanalyst Carl Jung. Jung treated Roland for approximately a year, by which time he had achieved some degree of sobriety. Roland returned to the United States full of hope, only to fall ill again with active alcoholism. Roland went back to Switzerland to see Jung again and asked for further treatment. Jung humbly told him that neither his science nor his art could help him any further, but that throughout man's history, rarely but from time to time, some people who had abandoned themselves completely to some spiritual organization had surrendered to God for help and had recovered. Roland returned to the United States dejected, but he followed Jung's advice, and he sought out an organization of that time called the Oxford Groups. These were groups of individuals who met regularly to discuss living life according to basic spiritual principles, very much like those adopted later by AA. Through this means, Roland in fact recovered, and his recovery was a source of astonishment to another concerned party named Edwin T., or Ebby, also an alcoholic hopeless beyond all help. When Roland told Ebby of how he had recovered, Ebby followed suit and also got sober. The pattern of one person helping another with the same problem then extended from Ebby to his friend Bill W., who had been hospitalized frequently for hopeless and curable alcoholism and whose condition was medically grave, and he was described as hopeless. Ebby told Bill that his recovery was based on service to others, moral housecleaning, anonymity, humility, and surrendering to a power greater than oneself. Bill W. was an atheist and found the idea of surrendering to a higher power unappealing, to say the least. The whole idea of surrender was abhorrent to Bill's pride. He sank into absolute black despair. He had a mental obsession with and a physical allergy to alcohol that condemned him to sickness, insanity, and death, a prognosis which had been clearly spelled out to him and to his wife, Lois. Ultimately, Bill gave up completely, at which point he had a profound experience of an infinite presence and light and felt a great sense of peace. That night he was finally able to sleep, and when he awoke the next day, he felt as though he had been transformed in some powerful, indescribable way. The validity and efficacy of this experience was confirmed by Dr. William Silkworth, his physician on the west side of New York City. Silkworth had treated 10,000 alcoholics, and in the process acquired enough wisdom to recognize the profound importance of Bill's experience. It was he who later introduced Bill to the great psychologist William James' classic book, The Varieties of Religious Experience. Bill wanted to pass his gift on to others, and as he himself said, spent the next few months trying to sober up drunks, but without success. Eventually he discovered that it was necessary to convince the subject of the hopelessness of his condition, in modern psychological terms, to overcome his denial. Bill's first success was with a surgeon from Akron, Ohio, Dr. Bob, who turned out to have a great aptitude for the spiritual and became a co-founder of AA. He never took another drink until his death in 1956, nor did Bill W. until he died in 1980. The enormous power which was realized through Bill W.'s inner experience has manifested itself externally in the millions of lives which have been transformed because of it. In Life magazine's listing of the 100 greatest Americans who have ever lived, Bill W. is credited with being the originator of the entire self-help movement. The story of Bill W. is typical of individuals who have been channels of great power. The principles they convey in a brief career reorders the lives of millions over long periods of time. Jesus Christ, for instance, taught for only 3 short years, and yet his teachings transformed all of Western society for all generations since. Man's encounter with these teachings lies at the center of Western history for the last 2,000 years. The highest calibrations of attractor power fields, which you have discovered, have invariably been associated with the teachings of the greatest spiritual masters of history. There is always a diminution from the calibrated power of the energy level of the original teachings of the great masters to their current practice in the form of organized religion. Yet the original principles themselves retain their innate attractor power pattern. It is merely their expression which has become weaker. The teachings themselves have the same profound power that they always did. The power of a principle remains unchanged throughout time. Whether we fully understand them or not, these principles are the ideals for which mankind strives. From our own struggles to better ourselves, we learn compassion for those still in the grip of inner conflict. Out of this grows a wisdom, including a compassion for the entire human condition. If we refer to the principles of advanced theoretical physics and the results of our own attractor research, it will be obvious that in a universe in which everything is connected with everything else, unseen power accomplishes for us things that we could never do by ourselves. As we have said before, we cannot see electricity, X-rays, or radio waves, but we know of their intrinsic power by virtue of their effects. Similarly, we constantly observe the effects of power in the world of thoughts and feelings, although until now it has not been considered possible to measure the energy or power of a thought. When we discuss high-power attractor fields, we frequently can allude to them only by means of symbols. National flags are just dyed patterns on pieces of material from a physical viewpoint, but men are willing to die for what they symbolize. Empowerment, as we have said, comes from meaning. Those things which have the greatest meaning to us arise from the spiritual and not from the material world. Thus far, we have seen that alignment with the principles associated with high-power attractor energy fields can result in Olympic achievement, success in commerce, political victory on an international level, and recovery from hopeless progressive diseases. These same attractor patterns are responsible for the finest music ever written. They are the basis of the most eminent religious teachings, the world's greatest art and architecture, and the wellspring of all creativity and genius.
Chapter 14, Power in the Arts.
The great works of art, music, and architecture, which have come down to us through the centuries, are enduring representations of the effect of high energy attractor patterns. In them, we see a reflection of the commitment of the master artists of our civilization to perfection and grace, and thereby to the ennoblement of humanity. The fine arts have always provided the venue for man's highest spiritual strivings in the secular realm. As far back as the time of the sculptor Phidias in ancient Greece, it has been the role of the arts to realize, in the physical media, ideals about which man could and should be, to sit down in tangible form, accessible to all, a distilled expression of the human spirit. Great art bodies forth the ordered essence not only of human experience, but of the world we live in. It is this that we call beauty. Like the theoretical physicist, the artist finds order in apparent chaos. Where there is only a block of meaningless marble, Michelangelo sees the David or Pieta, and with his chisel removes the extraneous stone to liberate that perfected image. Contemplating the random patterns of a meaningless plaster wall in the Sistine Chapel, he conceives through the inspiration of art a wondrous ABC, and then through the technique of art, he actualizes A to B to C, which we know as the Last Judgment. The bequest of the arts to man is internal too. In beholding realized beauty, a sensitivity to the beautiful is inculcated in us, enabling us to discover and create our own aesthetic rewards in the apparently disordered jumble of existence. Art and love are man's greatest gifts to himself. There is no art without love. Art is always the making of the soul, the craft of man's touch. Whether that touch is corporeal or the touch of the mind and spirit, so it has been since Neanderthal times, and so it will always be. Thus we find that computer-generated art and even great photographs never calibrate as highly as original paintings. A most interesting kinesiologic experiment, which anyone can reduplicate, is to test the strength of a person who is looking at an original painting, and then repeat the test, looking at a mechanical reproduction of that painting. When a person looks at something that has been handcrafted, he goes strong. When he looks at a reproduction, he goes weak. And this is true regardless of pictorial content. and original of a disturbing subject will make the test subject go stronger than a copy of a pleasant subject. Dedicated artists put love into their work. There is great power in both the human touch and human originality. Therefore, kinesiology provides a fail-safe detector of art forgery. The great psychoanalyst Carl Jung emphasized over and over again the relationship of art to the dignity of man and the importance of the human spirit in art. Jung himself and his work calibrate highest of all the famous psychoanalysts of history. Many of the others, aligned with such attractor patterns as material determinism, produce much lower scores. Music is in some ways the most subtle, in that it is the least concrete of the arts. However, in bypassing left-brain rationality to appeal directly to our subconscious right-brain sense of pattern, it is at the same time the most visceral and emotional. It also provides the easiest example of how attractor patterns order reality. If you wish to comprehend the difference between chaos and meaning, thereby attaining an effective definition of art, simply contemplate the difference between noise and music. A description of the creative process by the contemporary Estonian composer Arvo Pärt, whose work is often described as transcendental or mystical, condenses much of what we have observed regarding the crucial role of artistic genius in the unfoldment of attractor patterns. And he writes, "To write, I must prepare myself for a long time. Sometimes it takes 5 years. In my life, my music, my work, in my dark hours, I have the certain feeling that everything outside this one thing has no meaning. The complex and many-faceted only confuses me, and I must search for unity. What is it, this one thing, and how do I find my way to it? Traces of this thing appear in many guises, and everything that is unimportant falls away. Here I am, alone with silence. I have discovered that it is enough when a single note is beautifully played. That is my goal. Time and timelessness are connected. This instant and eternity are struggling within us." Among the arts, it is music that most readily brings tears to our eyes, or brings us to our feet, or inspires us to pinnacles of love and creativity. We have already noted that longevity seems to be a corollary of association with the attractor fields of classical music, whether as performer, conductor, or composer. Classical music often demonstrates extremely high inherent power patterns. Of all the arts, architecture is the most tangible and influential in the lives of men everywhere. We shop, go to work, and seek our entertainment in buildings. Thus, the form of the structure itself, because its influence is a background to so much human activity, deserves the utmost attention. Among the world's architecture, the great cathedrals elicit a special awe. Their energy patterns have calibrated the highest among architectural forms. This appears to be the result of several factors. Our experience of cathedrals can combine a number of arts simultaneously: music, sculpture, painting, spatial design. Moreover, these edifices are dedicated to the divine. That which is begotten in the name of the Creator is aligned with the highest attractor patterns of all. The cathedral not only inspires, but unifies, teaches, symbolizes, and serves all that is noblest in man. Beauty in architecture, however, need not be expansive nor grand in scale. There are few architectural settings more charming than the little thatched cottages dotting the Irish countryside, each one more quaint and picturesque than the last. Innate appreciation for the aesthetic allows in much traditional domestic architecture elegant statements of beauty via simplicity. Well-conceived public architecture speaks with historical authenticity of the beauty of line combined with utility. Function and beauty are impressively joined in the great subway stations of Russia and in the design and layout of many new high-rise apartment buildings in Canada. Older cultures seem always to have known the practicality of beauty, that which is designed without beauty quickly deteriorates. An architecturally ugly neighborhood becomes part of a feedback loop of blight and violence. The sleazy, dehumanized housing projects of urban ghettos manifest their weak power patterns as a matrix of squalor and crime, though it must be remembered that depending on which attractor pattern one aligns with, The destitution of the ghetto can be an excuse for depravity or the inspiration to rise above it. It is not the facts of one's environment, but one's attitude towards them that determines whether they will be the occasion for defeat or an inspiration to victory. Grace is the expression of the power of aesthetic sensitivity, and power is always manifested with grace, whether in beauty of line or style of expression. We associate grace with elegance, refinement, and economy of effort. We marvel at the grace of the Olympic athlete, just as we are uplifted by the grace of the Gothic cathedral. Gracious power patterns acknowledge and support life. They respect and uphold the dignity of others. Grace is an aspect of unconditional love. Graciousness also implies generosity, not merely material generosity, but generosity of spirit, such as the willingness to express thanks or acknowledge the importance of others in our lives. Grace is associated with modesty and humility. Power does not need to flaunt itself, though force always must because it originates in self-doubt. Great artists are thankful for their power, whatever its expression, because they know it is a gift for the good of mankind, entailing responsibility to others. Beauty has expressed itself in so many different forms in different cultures throughout various periods of time that we have good reason to say it is in the eye of the beholder. However, we should note that it is only the vehicle of beauty that changes. The essence of beauty does not change, only the form in which it is perceived. It is interesting that people of advanced consciousness are able to see beauty in all forms. To them, not only is all life sacred, but all form is beauty.
Chapter 15, Genius and the Power of Creativity.
Creativity and genius are the center of powerful high-energy attractors. No human talents are more germane to the creation of new M-fields or the unfoldment of the enfolded universe. In fact, these are the explicit domain of creativity and genius. Yet these closely allied processes remain shrouded in mystery. There is a paucity of information about the essential nature of either creativity or genius. Human history is the record of man's struggle to comprehend truths which to those of genius appear obvious. Genius is by definition a style of consciousness characterized by the ability to access high-energy attractor patterns. It is not a personality characteristic. It is not something that someone has, or even something that someone is. Those in whom we recognize genius commonly disclaim it. A universal characteristic of genius is humility. The genius has always attributed his insights to some higher influence. The process of animating genius most commonly involves first formulating a question, waiting an indefinite interval for consciousness to work with the problem, then suddenly the answer appears in a flash in a form which is characteristically nonverbal. Great musicians throughout history have stated they did not plan the music, but rather wrote down what they heard, finished within their own minds. The father of organic chemistry, Kakul, saw the pattern of the carbon ring organic nucleus in a dream. In an illuminated moment, Einstein had the revolutionary insight, which then took him years to translate into provable mathematics. Indeed, one of the main problems of genius is how to transform that which is perceived in one's private understanding into a visible expression comprehensible to others. The revelation itself is usually complete and self-explanatory to him who receives it, but to make it so to others may take a lifetime. Genius thus seems to proceed from sudden revelation rather than from conceptualization, and there is an unseen process involved. Although the genius's mind may appear stalled and frustrated with the problem, what it really is doing is preparing the field. There is a struggle with reason, which eventually leads, like a Zen koan, to a rational impasse from which the only way forward is by a leap from a lower to a higher attractor energy pattern. Attractor energy patterns have harmonics, as do musical tones. The higher frequency the harmonic, the higher the power. What the genius arrives at is a new harmonic. Every advance in human consciousness has come through a leap from a lower attractor pattern to a higher harmonic. Posing the original question activates an attractor The answer lies within its harmonic. This is why it is said that the question and the answer are merely two sides of one coin, and that one cannot pose a question unless the answer already exists. Otherwise, there would be no pattern from which the question could be formulated. Recognized genius is maybe rare.